Deemster had let go his grip in astonishment and turned toward Fergus, eyes bulging and blood-tinged saliva running down his chin. Germain, with more presence of mind than I would have had in such a situation, got hold of the reins and was hauling on them with all his strength, trying to turn Clarence's head. Clarence, whose blood was plainly up, was having none of it. Fergus calmly put the fired pistol back into his belt. I realized at this point that he must have fired into the dirt near the teamster's feet, and spoke to the man.
"If I were you, sir, I would remove myself promptly from this animal's presence. It is apparent that he dislikes you."
The shouting and screaming had stopped, and this made several people laugh.
"Got you there, Belden," a man near me called. "The mule dislikes you. What do you think of that?"
The teamster looked mildly dazed, but still homicidal. He stood with his fists clenched, legs braced wide apart, and shoulders hunched, glowering at the crowd.
"What I think," he began. "I think..."
But Percy had managed to get to his feet, and while still somewhat hunched, was mobile. Without hesitation, he walked up and kicked the teamster smartly in the balls. This went over well. Even the man who appeared to be a friend of Belden's whooped with laughter. The teamster didn't go down, but curled up like a dried leaf, clutching himself. Percy wisely didn't wait for him to recover, but turned and bowed to Fergus.
"À votre service, monsieur. I suggest that you and your son, and the mule, of course, might withdraw."
"Merci beaucoup, and I suggest you do the same tout suite," Fergus replied.
"Hey," shouted the teamster's friend, not laughing now. "You can't steal that mule."
Fergus rounded on him, imperious as the French aristocrat Percy had implied he might be.
"I cannot, sir," he said, inclining his head a quarter of an inch in acknowledgement. "Because a man cannot steal that which already belongs to him. Is this not so?"
"Is what not so?" demanded the man, confused.
Fergus scorned to answer this. Lifting one dark brow, he strode off several paces, turned, and shouted,
"Clarence, écoutez-moi."
With the teamster's collapse, Germain had succeeded in getting Clarence somewhat under control, though the mule's ears were still laid out flat in displeasure. At the sound of Fergus's voice, though, the ears rose slowly upright and swiveled in his direction. Fergus smiled, and I heard a woman behind me sigh involuntarily. Fergus's smile was remarkably charming. He reached into his pocket and withdrew an apple, which he skewered neatly on his hook.
"Come,"
he said to the mule, extending his right hand and twiddling the fingers in a head-scratching motion. Clarence came, disregarding Mr. Belden, who had now sat down and was clutching his knees, the better to contemplate his state of inner being. The mule ducked his head to take the apple, nudging Fergus's elbow, and allowed his forehead to be scratched. There was a murmur of interest and approbation from the crowd, and I noticed a few censorious glances being shot at the groaning Mr. Belden. The sense of being about to faint had left me, and now my insides began to unclench. With some effort, I slid the knife back into its sheath without stabbing myself in the thigh, and wiped my hand on my skirt.
"As for you, Sangrevel,"
Fergus was saying to Germain with a low-voiced menace that he'd plainly learned from Jamie,
"we have a few things to discuss presently."
Germain turned a rather sickly shade of yellow.
"Yes, Papa," he murmured, hanging his head in order to avoid his father's minatory eye.
"Get down," Fergus said to him,
and, turning to me, raised his voice.
"Madame Générale, permit me to present this animal personally to General Fraser, in the service of liberty."
This was delivered in such a tone of ringing sincerity that a few souls applauded. I accepted, as graciously as possible, on behalf of General Fraser. By the conclusion of these proceedings, Mr. Belden had got awkwardly to his feet and stumbled off toward the teamster's camp, tacitly ceding Clarence to the cause. I took Clarence's reins, relieved and glad to see him again. Apparently it was mutual, for he nosed me familiarly in the shoulder and made chummy huffing noises.
Fergus, meanwhile, stood for a moment, looking down at Germaine, then squared his shoulders and turned to Percy, who still looked a little pale, but had straightened his wig and regained his self-possession. Percy bowed very formally to Fergus, who sighed deeply, then bowed back.
"And I suppose that we too have matters to discuss, monsieur," he said, resigned. "Perhaps a little later."
Percy's handsome face lighted.
"À votre service, seigneur," he said,
and bowed again. Chapter 63. An alternate use for a penis syringe. Germaine had, in fact, found some honey, and now that the excitement of recovering Clarence was over, he produced a large chunk of sticky honeycomb wrapped in a dirty black kerchief from the recesses of his shirt.
"What are you going to do with that, Granny?" he asked, curious.
I'd set the oozing chunk of comb in a clean pottery dish and was again employing the useful penis syringe, carefully sterilized with alcohol, to suck up honey, being careful to avoid bits of wax and noticeable pollen grains. Having been designed for irrigation rather than puncture, the syringe had a blunt, smoothly tapered tip, just the thing for dribbling honey into someone's eye. "I'm going to lubricate his lordship's bad eye," I said. "Fergus, will you come and steady his lordship's head, please? Put your hand on his forehead. And, Germaine, you'll hold his eyelids open."
"I can keep still," John said irritably.
"Be quiet," I said briefly, and sat down on the stool beside him. "No one can keep still while having things poked into their eye."
"You were poking your bloody fingers into my eye not an hour since, and I didn't move."
"You squirmed," I said. "It's not your fault. You couldn't help it. Now be quiet. I don't want to accidentally stab you in the eyeball with this." Breathing audibly through his nose, he clamped his mouth shut and suffered Fergus and Germaine to immobilize him. I debated whether to dilute the honey with boiled water, but the heat of the day had made it sufficiently thin that I thought it better to use it at full strength. "It's antibacterial," I explained to the three of them, using my cautery iron again to lift the eyeball and squirting a slow dribble of honey under it. "That means it kills germs." Fergus and Germaine, to whom I had explained germs more than once, nodded intelligently and tried to look as though they believed in the existence of such things, which they didn't. John opened his mouth as though to speak, but then shut it again and exhaled strongly through his nose. "But the chief virtue of honey in the present instance," I went on, anointing the eyeball generously, "is that it's viscous. Let go now, Germaine. Blink, John. Oh, very good." The handling had, of course, made the eye water, but even dilute honey retains its viscosity. I could see the altered gleam of the light across the sclera, indicating the presence of a thin, soothing, I hoped, layer of honey. Some had overflowed, of course, and amber beads were sliding down his temple toward his ear. I staunched the flow with a handkerchief. "How does it feel?" John opened and closed his eye a couple of times, very slowly.
"Everything looks blurry."
"Doesn't matter. You aren't going to be looking out of that eye for a day or two anyway. Does it feel any better?"
"Yes," he said,
in a distinctly grudging manner, and the other three of us made approving noises that made him look embarrassed. "Right, then. Sit up, carefully. Yes, that's it. Close your eye and hold this to catch the drips." And handing him a clean handkerchief, I unrolled a length of gauze bandage, thumbed a pad of lint carefully into the eye socket, and rolled the bandage round his head a few times, tucking in the ends. He strongly resembled a figure in an old painting titled The Spirit of 76, but I didn't mention it. "All right," I said, exhaling and feeling rather pleased with myself. "Fergus, why don't you and Germaine go and find some food? Something for his lordship, and something for the road tomorrow. I rather think it will be a long day."
"This one's been quite long enough already," John said.
He was swaying a little, and I pushed him gently back down with little resistance. He stretched his neck to ease it, then settled on the pillow with a sigh.
"Thank you."
"It was my pleasure," I assured him. I hesitated, but with Fergus's departure, I didn't think I'd have a better chance to ask what was in my mind.
I don't suppose you know what Percival Beauchamp wants with Fergus, do you?
The good eye opened and looked at me.
You mean you don't think he believes Fergus to be the lost heir to a great fortune? No, I don't either. But if Mr. Fraser will take a bit of unsolicited advice, I'd strongly suggest having as little as possible to do with Monsieur Beauchamp.
The eye had closed again. Percy Beauchamp had taken his leave very gracefully after Clarence's rescue, explaining that he must attend Le Marquis, but adding that he would seek out Fergus on the morrow.
When things are quieter, he'd added with a genteel bow.
I regarded John thoughtfully.
What did he do to you? I asked.
He didn't open his eye, but his lips tightened.
To me? Nothing. Nothing at all, he repeated,
and turned over on his side with his back to me. Chapter 64 301
300 men.
Jamie stepped into the darkness beyond the 16th New Jersey's campfire and paused for a moment to let his eyes adjust.
300 bloody men. He'd never led a band of more than 50, and never had much in the way of subalterns, no more than one or two men under him.
Now he had 10 militia companies, each with its own captain and a few informally appointed lieutenants, and Lee had given him a staff of his own. 2 aides de camp, a secretary. Now that he could get used to, he thought, flexing the fingers of his maimed right hand. 3 captains, one of whom was striding along at his shoulder, trying not to look worried. 10 of his own lieutenants, who would serve as liaison between him and the companies under his command. A cook, an assistant cook. And, of course, he had a surgeon already. Despite the preoccupations of the moment, the memory of Lee's face when Jamie told him exactly why he didn't need an army surgeon assigned to him made him smile.
Indeed,
Lee had said, his long-nosed face going blank. Then he'd gathered his wits and gone red in the face, thinking himself practiced upon. But Jamie had pushed back his cuff and shown Lee his right hand, the old white scars on his fingers like tiny starbursts where the bones had come through, and the broad one, still red, but neat, straight, and beautifully knit, running down between the middle finger and the little one, showing where the missing finger had been amputated with such skill that one had to look twice to see why the hand seemed strange.
"Well, General, your wife seems a most accomplished needlewoman," Lee said, now amused. "Aye, sir, she is," he said politely, "and a very bonny hand with a blade, too."
Lee gave him a sardonic look and spread out the fingers of his own right hand. The outer two were missing.
"So was the gentleman who took these off me. A duel," he added offhandedly, seeing Jamie's raised brows, and curled up his hand again. "In Italy."
He didn't know about Lee. The man had a reputation, but he was a boaster, and the two didn't often go together.
On the other hand, he was as proud as one of Louis's camels, and arrogance sometimes did mark a man who kent his worth.
The plan to attack the British rearguard, at first intended as a quick strike by Lafayette and 1,000 men, Lee scorning such a minor command, had grown more elaborate, as such things always did if you gave commanders time to think about them. Once Washington had decided that the expeditionary force should be 5,000 men, Lee had graciously condescended to this more appropriate command, leaving Lafayette in charge of his own smaller force, for the sake of the Marquis's amour-propre, but with Lee in command overall. Jamie had his doubts, but it wasn't his place to voice them. He glanced to his left, where Ian and his dog were ambling along, the former whistling to himself, and the latter, a huge, shaggy shape in the dark, panting from the heat.
"Ian," he said casually, in Gaelic, "did your friends with the feathers have aught to say about Una Waterica?" "They had, uncle," Ian replied in the same language. "Not much, though, for they know him only by repute.
He's a most ferocious fighter, or so it's said.
The Mohawk was certainly ferocious, and did set great store by personal courage. But he thought they had a negligible grasp of strategy, tactics, and judgment. He was about to ask about Joseph Brant, who was likely the closest thing to a general, in the formal sense, among the Mohawk, but was interrupted by a tall, gangling form stepping out in front of him.
"I beg your pardon, sir. Might I have a word?" the man said, looking right at left at Jamie's companions, added, "A private word?"
"Certainly, Captain Woodsworth," he replied, hoping his hesitation in finding the man's name was small enough to pass unnoticed. He'd memorized all the militia captains as he met them, and as many men as he could, but their names wouldn't come easy to him for a bit yet. After a moment's further hesitation, he nodded to Ian to go on with Captain Hewell to the next fire.
"Tell them what's afoot, Captain," he said, for the next fire was one of Hewell's assigned companies. "But wait for me there, aye?"
"What's afoot?" Woodsworth repeated, sounding alarmed.
"What's happening? Are we to go now?"
"Not yet, Captain. Come aside, aye? Else we'll be trampled."
For they were standing in the path that led from the fires to a set of hastily dug latrine trenches. He could smell the acrid tang of ordure and quicklime from here. Leading Woodsworth aside, he acquainted him with the change of commander for the morning, but assured him that this would make no real difference to the militia companies under Jamie's command. They would receive their orders in the normal way. He thought privately that it wouldn't make a difference in how the companies operated. It might well make a difference as to whether they met battle on the morrow or not, and whether they survived if they did. But there was no telling whether the better odds lay with Lafayette or Lee. Chances were that sheer accident, fate, or just possibly God would decide.
"No, sir," he said. "You wish to speak with me?"
"Oh." Woodsworth inhaled through his nose and straightened himself, hastily retrieving the words of whatever speech he'd composed.
"Yes, sir. I wish to inquire after the disposition made of Bertram Armstrong."
"Bertram what?"
"The man you took from from the lines earlier today, with a little boy."
Jamie didn't know whether to laugh or be annoyed.
"Bertram?"
"The man is well enough disposed for the present, sir. My wife's seen to his eye, and he's been fed."
"Oh."
Woodsworth shuffled his feet, but stood his ground.
"I'm glad of that, sir. But what I meant, I am concerned for him. There is talk about him."
"I'm sure there is,"
Jamie said, not bothering to hide the edge in his voice.
"And what is your concern, sir?"
"They are saying, the men from Dunning's company, that Armstrong is a government spy, that he's a British officer who concealed himself among us, that they found a commission upon him and correspondence. I..."
He paused and gulped breath, the next words coming out in a rush.
"I cannot believe it of him, sir, nor can any of us. We feel that some mistake must have been made, and we wish to say that we hope nothing hasty will be done."
"No one has suggested anything of the sort, Captain,"
Jamie assured him, alarm running down his spine like quicksilver.
"Only because they haven't had time."
He'd been able to ignore the thorny problem Grey presented as a prisoner in the fierce rush of preparation and the fiercer rush of his own feelings, but he couldn't ignore it much longer. He should have notified Lafayette, Lee, and Washington of Grey's presence immediately, but had gambled on the confusion of imminent battle to disguise his delay. His eyes had grown used to the scattered light of stars and fire. He could see Woodsworth's long face, apologetic, but determined.
"Yes. I hesitate to speak so frankly, sir, but the sorry fact is that when men's passions run high, regrettable actions, irretrievable actions, may be taken."
Woodsworth swallowed audibly.
"I should not like to see that."
"You think someone might see fit to take such action?"
"No." He glanced round at the encircling fires. He could see bodies moving, restless as the flames, dark shadows in the woods, but he caught no sense of riot, no pulse of anger.
A murmur of talk, to be sure. Voices raised in excitement, bursts of laughter, and even singing. But it was a nervous spirit of anticipation,
expectation, not the sullen rumble of a mob.
I am a clergyman, sir.
Woodsworth's voice was stronger now, urgent.
I know how men may turn to evil conversation, and how quickly such conversation may turn to action. One drink too many, a careless word.
Aye, you're right about that,
Jamie said. He cursed himself for not having thought of this possibility. He'd let his own feelings cloud his mind. Of course, he'd had no idea when he left Grey that he'd been carrying a commission, but that was no excuse.
I've sent word to General Lee about Mr. Armstrong. Should you hear any more talk about the man, you might let it be known that the matter is in official hands. That might prevent anything regrettably informal happening.
Woodsworth's sigh of relief was palpable.
Yes, sir, he said with gratitude. I shall certainly let that be known.
He stepped aside, bobbing his head, but then stopped, struck by a thought.
Oh, aye,
Jamie spoke impatiently. He felt assailed from all sides by swarms of tiny stinging troubles and was inclined to swat at this one.
I trust you will forgive my persistence, General, but I just thought, the boy who was with Armstrong, Bobby Higgins, he's called.
All Jamie's senses were instantly alert.
What about him? Armstrong. The boy said he was in search of his grandfather, and Armstrong said he knew the man, and that his name was James Fraser.
Jamie shut his eyes. If no one lynched John Grey before dawn, he might throttle the man himself.
The boy is indeed my grandson, Captain,
he said as evenly as he could, opening his eyes.
Which means I ken bloody Bert Armstrong.
And if that small bit of information became generally known, there were going to be a lot of very awkward questions asked by people in a position to demand answers.
My wife is caring for him.
Oh, good.
I just wish to make known your concern.
Aye, Captain. I thank you. Good night.
Woodsworth bowed and stepped back, murmuring good night in his turn, and disappeared into a night that was far from good and getting worse by the moment. Jamie jerked his coat straight and strode on. 300 men to inform and command, to rouse, lead, and control. 300 lives in his hands.
301.
Chapter 65. Mosquitoes. Jamie walked into the light of the fire quite late, smiled at me, and sat down suddenly.
Is there food?
He asked.
There is, sir, said the woman who was stirring it. And you'll have some too, ma'am,
she added firmly, giving me a look that strongly suggested that I was not looking my very best. I wasn't disposed to care, but accepted with thanks a wooden bowl of something hot and a chunk of bread to eat it with. I barely noticed what I ate, though I was ravenous. The day had been so filled with activity that I hadn't had time to eat. Would not have eaten at all, in fact, had I not brought food for John, at which point he insisted that I sit down for 10 minutes and eat with him. Percy Beauchamp had not come back. That was something on the plus side of the ledger, I supposed. There had been a couple of dozen men from Jamie's companies that I rejected by reason of disfirmity, crippled, asthmatic, collapsed with age, and perhaps 36 more who were essentially sound, but sporting some injury requiring attention. These mostly the results of fistfights or falling down while under the influence of drink. Several of them were still under the influence of drink, and had been sent off under guard to sleep it off. I did wonder for a moment how many men normally went into battle drunk. In all honesty, I'd be strongly tempted to do it myself, were I required to do what these men were about to do. There was still a tremendous bustle, but the earlier sense of exhilaration had transmuted into something more concentrated, more focused and sober. Preparations were being made in earnest. I'd finished my own, or hoped I had. A small tent for shelter from the blazing sun, packs of medical supplies, surgical kits, each equipped with a jar of wet sutures, a wad of lint for mopping up blood, and a bottle of dilute alcohol.
I'd run out of salt, and couldn't summon the will to badger or beg more from the commissary officer.
I try to do it in the morning, and the emergency kit that I carried over my shoulder, no matter what. I sat close to the fire, but despite that, and in spite of the warmth of the night itself, I began to feel chilled and heavy, as though I was slowly ossifying, and only then realized how tired I was. The camp hadn't gone to sleep entirely. There was still talk around the fires, and the occasional rasp of a scythe or a sword being sharpened, but the volume had dropped. The atmosphere had settled with the sinking of the moon, even those souls most excited at the prospect of imminent battle succumbing to sleep. "Come and lie down," I said softly to Jamie, and rose from my seat with a muffled groan. "It won't be for long, but you need some rest, and so do I."
"Aye, all right, but I canna be under canvas," he said, low-voiced, following me. "I feel half smothered, couldn't breathe in a tent."
"Well, plenty of room outside," I said, nobly suppressing a twinge at the thought of sleeping on the ground. Fetching a couple of blankets, I followed him, yawning, a little way along the river bank, until we found a private spot behind the scrim of willows that dragged their leaves in the water. In fact, it was surprisingly comfortable. There was a thick growth of springy grass on which to spread the blankets, and so close to the water, the air was at least moving, cool on my skin. I shucked out of my petticoats and took my stays completely off, with a blissful shiver of relief as the coolness stirred gently through my damp shift. Jamie had stripped to his shirt and was rubbing his face and legs with mosquito ointment, the presence of hordes of these insects accounting for the lack of company near the water. I sat down beside him and helped myself to a small scoop of the mint-smelling grease. Mosquitoes seldom bit me, but that didn't stop them whining past my ears and poking inquisitively into my mouth and nostrils, which I found disconcerting in the extreme. I lay back, watching as he finished his more thorough anointing. I could feel the distant approach of morning, but longed all the more for whatever brief oblivion I could get before the sun rose and all hell broke loose. Jamie closed the tin and stretched out beside me with a low groan, black leaf shadows trembling over the paleness of his shirt. I rolled toward him, just as he rolled toward me, and we met with a blind and groping kiss, smiling against each other's mouth, wriggling and squirming to find a good way of lying together. Warm as it was, I wanted to be touching him.
He wanted to be touching me, too.
"Really?" I said, astonished. "How can you possibly... You've been up for hours."
"No, only the last minute or two," he assured me. "I'm sorry, Sassenach. I ken you're tired, and I wouldn't ask. But I'm desperate."
He let go of my bottom long enough to pull up his shirt, and I rather resignedly started disentangling my shift from my legs.
"I dinna mind if you fall asleep while I'm about my business,"
he said in my ear, feeling his way one-handed.
"I willna take long about it. I just..."
"The mosquitoes will bite your arse," I said, wriggling my own arse into a better position and opening my legs. "Hadn't I best put some..."
"Oh!" "Oh," he said, sounding pleased. "Well, that's all right if you want to stay awake, of course."
I pinched his buttock hard, and he gave a small yelp, laughed, and licked my ear. The fit was a bit dry, and he fumbled for the tin of mosquito ointment. "Are you sure..." I began dubiously.
"Oh."
He was already applying the half-liquid ointment with more enthusiasm than dexterity, but the fact of his enthusiasm was more arousing than skill might have been. Having a small amount of oil of peppermint vigorously applied to one's private parts was a rather novel sensation, too.
"Make that noise again," he said, breathing heavily in my ear. "I like it."
He was right. It didn't take long. He lay half on and half off me, panting, his heart beating slow and hard against my breast. I had my legs wrapped round him. I could feel the flutter of tiny insects on my ankles and bare feet as they swarmed, avid for his unprotected bare flesh, and didn't mean to let him go. I squeezed him close, rocking gently, slippery and tingling, and I didn't take long either. My quivering legs relaxed, releasing him. "Shall I tell you something?" I said, after a bit of mint-scented heavy breathing. "The mosquitoes won't bite your cock."
"I don't mind if they carry me off to their lair to feed to their bairns," he murmured. "Come here, Sasmach."
I pushed damp hair out of my face and settled contentedly in the hollow of his shoulder, his arm around me. By now I had reached that sense of accommodation with the humid atmosphere, in which I stopped trying to keep track of my own body's boundaries, and simply melted into sleep. I slept without dreaming, and without moving, until a touch of cramp in my left foot roused me enough to shift a little. Jamie raised his arm a bit, then replaced it as I settled again, and I became aware that he wasn't asleep.
"You all right?" I murmured, thick-tongued with drowsiness. "Aye, fine," he whispered, and his hand smoothed the hair from my cheek. "Go back to sleep, Sasnach. I'll wake you when it's time."
My mouth was sticky, and it took a moment to locate any words.
"You need to sleep too."
"No,"
he said, soft but definite.
"No. I didn't mean to sleep. So close to the battle. I have dreams. I've had them the last 3 nights, and they get worse."
My own arm was lying across his midsection. At this, I reached up involuntarily, putting my hand over his heart. I knew he dreamed. And I had a very good idea what he'd dreamed about from the things he'd said in his sleep, and the way he'd wakened, trembling.
"They get worse."
"Shh," he said, and bent his head to kiss my hair.
"Then a fashion, Ian. I want only to lie here with you in my arms, to keep you safe and watch you sleep. I can rise then with a clear mind, and go to do what must be done."
Chapter 66. War Paint. Nessun dorma. None shall sleep. It was a song, an aria, Brianna had called it, from an opera she knew. She'd played a part in it at her university, dressed up in Chinese robes. Ian smiled at the thought of his cousin, taller than most men, striding up and down on a stage, swishing her silk robes about her. He wished he'd seen that. He'd thought of her from the moment he'd opened the little deerskin bag that held his paints. She was a painter, Bree, and a good one. She ground her own pigments, and she'd made his red ochre for him, and the black and white from charcoal and dried clay, and made for him, too, a deep green from ground malachite, and a brilliant yellow from the gall of the buffalo she and her mother had killed. No other man had such deep colours to his paint, and he wished for a moment that Eats Turtles and some of his other Mohawk clan brothers could be with him to admire them. The noise of the distant camp was like the singing of cicadas in the trees near a river, a buzz too loud to think through, but one that went away as you got used to it.
"None shall sleep. The women and children, they might sleep, but the whores surely didn't. Not tonight."
He felt a twitch at the thought, but dismissed it. Thought of Rachel and dismissed her too, but reluctantly. He opened the willow bark box of deer fat and anointed his face and chest and shoulders with it, slowly, focusing his mind. Normally he'd speak to the spirits of the earth as he did this, and then to his own particular saints, Michael and Bride. But he wasn't seeing Michael or Bride. Brianna was still faintly with him. But what he was feeling was a strong sense of his da, which was disconcerting. It didn't seem respectful to be dismissing his own father. He stopped what he was doing and closed his eyes instead, waiting to see if maybe Da had a thing to tell him.
"I hope you're no bringing me word of my death, aye?" he said aloud. "Because I dinna mean to die until I've lain with Rachel, at least."
"Well, there's a noble goal, to be sure."
The dry voice was Uncle Jamie's, and Ian's eyes popped open. His uncle was standing among the trailing fronds of a river willow, dressed in nothing but his shirt.
"Out of uniform, are you not, Uncle?" he said,
though his heart had leapt in his chest like a startled deer mouse.
"General Washington will not be pleased."
Washington was a great stickler for proper uniform.
"Officers must be dressed suitably at all times."
He said the Continentals couldn't be taken seriously as an army, did they come to the field looking and acting like a rabble in arms.
"I'm sorry to interrupt you, Ian," Uncle Jamie said, stepping out from the willow.
The moon was nearly down.
It was nae more than a ghost, bare-legged in his floating sark.
"Who were you speaking to, though?"
"Oh, my da. He was just there in my mind, Ken. I mean, I think of him often, but it's nae sae often I feel him with me. So I wondered, had he come to tell me I'd die this day?"
Jamie nodded, not seeming bothered at the thought.
"I doubt it," he said. "You're putting on your paint, aye? Getting ready, I mean."
"I was about to. You want some, too?"
It was only half said in jest, and Jamie took it that way.
"I would, Ian. But I think General Washington might have me strung up by the thumbs and flogged should I come before him, wi' my troops all marshalled, and me wi' war paint on."
Ian made a small sound of amusement and scooped two fingers into the dish of red ochre, which he began to rub on his chest.
"And what are you doing out here in your sark, then?"
"Washing," Jamie said,
but in a tone indicating that that wasn't all of it.
"And talking to my ain dead."
"Mm-hmm. Anyone in particular?"
"My Uncle Dougal and Murta, him who was my godfather. They're the two I'd most want with me in battle."
Jamie made a small, restless movement.
"If I can, I make a wee moment to be alone before a fight. To wash, Ken, and pray a bit, and then to just ask if they'll bide wi' me as I go."
Ian thought this interesting. He hadn't known either man himself. They'd both died at Culloden, but he'd heard stories.
"Bonny fighters," he said. "Did you ask my da, too? To go wi', I mean. Perhaps that's why he's about."
Jamie turned his head sharply toward Ian, surprised, then relaxed, shaking his head.
"I never had to ask Ian more," he said softly. "He was always just with me."
He gestured briefly to the darkness on his right. Ian's eyes stung and his throat closed, but it was dark. It didn't matter. He cleared his throat and held out one of the tiny dishes.
"Will you help me, Uncle Jamie?"
"Oh, aye, surely.
How do you want it?"
"Red across my forehead. I can do that bit. But black from the wee dots to the chin."
He drew a finger across the line of tattooed dots that curved under his cheekbones.
"Black's for strength, aye? It declares you're a warrior. And yellow means you're no afraid to die. Och, aye. Are you wanting the yellow today?"
"No."
He let the smile show in his voice, and Jamie laughed.
"Mm-hmm."
Jamie dabbed with a rabbit foot brush, then spread the colour evenly with his thumb. Ian closed his eyes, feeling strength come into him with the touch.
"Do you usually do this alone, Ian? Seems hard, save you've a looking-glass."
"Mostly. Or sometimes we do it together, and a clan brother would paint you. If it's an important thing, a big raid, say, or going to make war on someone, then the medicine man would paint us and sing."
"Tell me you dinna want me to sing, Ian," his uncle murmured. "I mean, I'd try, but I'll do without, thanks."
Black for the lower face, red on the forehead, and a band of the malachite green following the line of his tattoos, from ear to ear, across the bridge of his nose. Ian peered at the small dishes of pigment. It was easy to spot the white, and he pointed to it.
"Can you maybe draw a wee arrow, Uncle, across my forehead?"
He drew a finger from left to right, showing where.
I can, aye.
Jamie's head was bent over the paint dishes, hand hovering.
Did you not tell me once that white is for peace, though?
Aye.
Should you be going to parley or trade, you use a good deal of white. But it's for the morning, too, so if you go to avenge someone, you'd maybe wear white.
Jamie's head came up at that, staring at him.
This one's no for vengeance, Ian said. It's for Flying Arrow, the dead man whose place I took when I was adopted.
He spoke as casually as he could, but he felt his uncle tighten and look down. Neither one of them was ever going to forget that day of parting when he'd gone to the Kayenkahaka, and both of them had thought it was forever. He leaned over and put a hand on Jamie's arm.
That day, you said to me, "Remember, Uncle Jamie." And I did.
So did I, Ian,
Jamie said softly, and drew the arrow on his forehead, his touch like a priest's on Ash Wednesday, marking Ian with the sign of the cross.
So did we all. Is that it?
Ian touched the green stripe gingerly to be sure it was dry enough.
Aye, I think so. Ken Brianna made me the paints. I was thinking of her. But then I thought I maybe shouldn't have taken her with me that way.
He felt Jamie's breath on his skin as his uncle gave a small snort, then sat back.
You always carry your women wee into battle, Ian Og. They're the root of your strength, man.
Why?
That made sense, and it was a relief to him. Still,
I was thinking it maybe wasn't right to think of Rachel in such a place, though. Her being Quaker and all.
Jamie dipped his middle finger into the deer fat, then delicately into the white clay powder, and drew a wide swooping V near the crest of Ian's right shoulder. Even in the dark it showed vividly.
White dove, he said with a nod.
He sounded pleased.
There's Rachel for you.
He wiped his fingers on the rock, then rose and stretched. Ian saw him turn to look toward the east. It was still night, but the air had changed just in the few minutes they'd sat. His uncle's tall figure was distinct against the sky where, a little before, he'd seemed part of the night.
An hour, nae more, Jamie said. Eat first, aye.
And with that, turned and walked away to the stream and his own interrupted prayers. Chapter 67.
Reaching for things that aren't there.
William wished he could stop reaching for things that weren't there. A dozen times today, oftener, he'd reached for the dagger that should have been on his belt, once or twice for one of his pistols. Slapped an impotent hand against his hip, missing his sword, missing the small solid weight of his shot pouch, the swing of his cartridge box. And now he lay sweating naked on his cot, hands slapped flat on his chest, where he'd reached without thinking for the wooden rosary. The rosary that, if he'd had it, would no longer be the comfort it had been for so many years. The rosary that, if he'd had it, no longer said muck to him. If he did still have it, he'd have snatched it off and thrown it into the nearest fire. That's likely what James Fraser had done with it after William had thrown the rosary in the bastard's face. But then, Fraser wasn't the bastard here, was he? He muttered, "Shice," and flung himself irritably over. 3 feet away, Evan stirred and farted in his sleep, a sudden muffled sound like distant cannon. On the other side, Merbling went on snoring.
"Tomorrow."
He'd gone to bed late after an exhausting day and would be up in an hour, maybe. But he lay wide awake, eyes so adapted to the dark that he could see the pale blur of the tent canvas overhead. No chance of sleep, he knew. Even if he'd see no action himself, and he wouldn't, the proximity of battle had him so keyed up that he could have leapt from bed and gone straight for the enemy right now, sword in hand. There'd be a battle. Maybe not a big one, but the rebels were yapping at their heels, and tomorrow,
today, there would be a meeting. It might put pay to Washington's ambitions, though Sir Henry was firm that this was not his goal. He meant to get his army and the people under its protection to New York. That was all that mattered. Though, if his officers should choose to demonstrate their military superiority while doing so, he had no great objection. William had stood at attention behind Sir Henry's chair at dinner, his back against the tent wall, listening attentively while the plans were drawn up. Had, in fact, the honour of carrying the formal written orders to von Kniphausen, whose troops were to march to Middletown, while Clinton's brigade would form up at the rear to engage the rebels, while my Lord Cornwallis's escorted the baggage train on to safety. That's why he'd been so late getting to bed. He yawned suddenly, surprising himself, and settled back, blinking. Maybe he could sleep a bit after all. Thinking of dinner and orders and such mundanities as the colour of von Kniphausen's nightshirt. It was pink silk, with purple pansies embroidered round the neck. Rather than the oncoming battle, had calmed his mind amazingly. Distraction. That's what he needed.
Worth a try, he supposed.
He squirmed into the most comfortable attitude he could manage, closed his eyes, and began mentally extracting the square roots of numbers greater than 100. He'd got to the square root of 117 and was muzzily groping for the product of 12 and 6 when he felt the sudden stir of air on his damp skin. He sighed and opened his eyes, thinking that Merbling had got up for a piss, but it wasn't Merbling. A dark figure stood just inside the tent flap. The flap wasn't closed, and the figure was clearly visible against the faint glow from the banked campfires outside.
A girl?
He sat up fast, groping one-handed for the shirt he'd tossed to the foot of his cot.
"What the devil are you doing here?"
he whispered as softly as he could. She'd been hovering, uncertain. But hearing him speak, she came straight for him, and the next thing he knew, her hands were on his shoulders, her hair brushing his face. He put up his own hands in reflex and found that she was in her shift, her breasts free and warm under it, a few inches from his face. She pulled back, and in what seemed like the same motion, skimmed the shift off over her head, shook out her hair, and straddled him, her moist round thighs pressing his.
"Get off!"
He grabbed her by the arms, pushing her away. Merbling stopped snoring. Evan's bedclothes rustled. William stood up, snatched up her shift and his shirt, and taking her by the arm, marched her out of the tent as quietly as he could.
"What the devil do you think you're doing? Here, put that on."
He thrust the shift unceremoniously into her arms and hastily pulled his shirt on. They were not in full view of anyone, but might be at any moment. Her head emerged from the shift like a flower popping out of a snowbank. A rather angry flower.
"Well, what do you think I was doing?" she said.
She pulled her hair free of the shift and fluffed it violently.
"I was trying to do you a kindness."
"A what?"
"You're going to fight tomorrow, aren't you?"
There was enough light to see the shine of her eyes as she glared at him.
"Soldiers always want to fuck before a fight. They need it."
He rubbed a hand hard over his face, palm rasping on his sprouting whiskers, then took a deep breath.
"I see. Yes.
Very kind of you." He suddenly wanted to laugh. He also, very suddenly, wanted to take advantage of her offer. But not enough to do it with Merbling on one side and Evans on the other, ears flapping.
"I'm not going to fight tomorrow," he said,
and the pang it caused him to say that out loud startled him.
"You're not? Why not?"
She sounded startled too, and more than a little disapproving.
"It's a long story," he said, struggling for patience, "and it's not your business.
Now look. I appreciate the thought, but I told you, you're not a whore. At least, not for the time being.
And you're not my whore."
Though his imagination was busy with images of what might have happened had she stolen into his cot and taken hold of him before he was fully awake. He put the thought firmly aside, and taking her by the shoulders, turned her around.
Go back to your own bed now, he said, but couldn't stop himself from patting her very nice ass in farewell.
She turned her head and glared at him over her shoulder.
Coward, she said. A man that won't fuck won't fight.
What? For an instant he didn't think she'd really said it, but she had.
You heard me. Good fucking night.
He reached her in two strides, seized her shoulder, and whirled her round to face him.
And who gave you that bit of wisdom, may I ask?
Your good friend, Captain Harkness?
He wasn't truly angry, but the shock of her unexpected arrival was still reverberating in his blood, and he was annoyed.
Did I save you from buggery so you could throw my circumstances in my face?
Her chin drew back, and she breathed hard, but not in apparent distress.
What circumstances? She demanded.
I told you, bloody hell. Do you know what the Convention Army is?
No.
Well, that's the long story, and I'm not telling you it standing in my shirt in the middle of camp. Now bugger off and take care of your sister and the lads. That's your job. I'll take care of myself.
She exhaled sharply with a pfft sound.
Doubtless you will, she said, with a maximum of sarcasm, and a pointed glance at his cock, which was poking absurdly at his shirt, making its own urgent preferences known.
Scheiße, he said again briefly,
then grabbed her in a bear hug that pressed her body against his all the way down, and kissed her. She struggled, but after the first moment he realized that the struggle wasn't meant to procure her release, but to provoke him further. He tightened his grip until she stopped, but didn't quit kissing her for some time thereafter. He finally let go, panting and bedewed with perspiration. The air was like breathing hot tar. She was panting too. He could take her, wanted to, push her down on her knees in the grass beside the tent, pull up her shift and have her from behind. It wouldn't take more than seconds.
No,
he said, and wiped his mouth on the back of his hand.
No,
he said again, more positively. Every nerve in his body wanted her, and had he been 16, it would have been long over by this time. But he wasn't, and he had just enough self-control to turn her round again. He gripped her by the scruff and buttock to keep her from turning back, and held her immobile.
When we get to New York, he whispered, bending to speak in her ear, I'll think again.
She stiffened, her buttock rounding hard in his hand, but didn't pull away or try to bite him, which he'd half expected.
Why? She said, in a calm voice.
That's a long story, too, he said. Good night, Jane.
And releasing her, stalked away into the dark. Nearby, the drums of reveille began. Part 4. Day of Battle. Chapter 68. Go Out in Darkness. Ian had been over the land briefly the day before, scouting.
And a good thing, too, he said under his breath.
It was the dark of the moon, and he must go canny and keep the road. He wasn't risking his horse's legs over the rough land before he had to. And, bride grant him, the sky would be fully light by then. Still, he was glad of the dark and the solitude. Not that the land was still. The woods lived at night, and many things came out in the strange dawn hour when the light began to swell. But neither the rustle of hares and voles, nor the sleepy call of waking birds demanded his notice, or took any notice of him. He had finished his own prayers after Uncle Jamie left him, then departed alone in silence, and the peace of his preparations was still on him. When he had lived with the Mohawk, particularly when things had gone wrong with Emily, he would leave the longhouse for days, hunting alone with Rollo, until the wilderness had eased his spirit enough to go back, strengthened. He glanced down by reflex, but Rollo had been left behind with Rachel. The wound from the deadfall trap was clean. Auntie Claire had put something on it that helped. But he wouldn't have let Rollo come to a battle like this one offered to be, even had he been whole and a good deal younger than he was. There was no doubt of the coming battle. He could smell it. His body was rising toward the fight. He could feel the tingling of it. But he treasured this momentary stillness the more for that.
"Won't last long, mind,"
he said softly to the horse, who ignored him. He touched the white dove on his shoulder and rode on, still quiet, but not alone. The men had lain on their arms all night by Sir Henry's orders. While one didn't actually lie on the musket and cartridge box, there was something about sleeping with a gun touching your body that kept you alert, ready to rouse from sleep in nothing flat. William had no arms to lie on, and hadn't needed rousing, as he hadn't slept, but was no less alert for the lack. He wouldn't be fighting, and deeply regretted that, but he would be out in it, by God. The camp was a bustle, drums rattling up and down the aisles of tents, summoning the soldiers, and the air was full of the smells of baking bread, pork, and hot peas porridge. There was no visible sign of dawn yet, but he could feel the sun there, just below the horizon, rising with the slow inevitability of its daily dominion. The thought reminded him vividly of the whale he'd seen on the voyage to America, a dark shadow below the ship's side, easily dismissed as the change of light on the waves. And then, slowly, the growing bulk, the realization, and the breathless wonder of seeing it rise so close, so huge, and suddenly there. He fastened his garters and tugged them tight before buckling his knee bands and pulling on his Hessian boots. At least he had his gorget back to lend a touch of ceremony to the mundane task of getting dressed. The gorget, of course, reminded him of Jane. Was he ever going to be able to wear it without thinking of the damned girl? And of recent events. He'd regretted not accepting her offer, and still did. He could still smell her scent, musky and soft, like putting his face in thick fur. Her remark still rankled too, and he snorted, settling his coat on his shoulders. Perhaps he'd think again before they reached New York. These idle thoughts were interrupted by the appearance of another of Sir Henry's aides, Captain Crosby, who popped his head through the tent flap, clearly in a great flurry. "Oh, there you are, Ellesmere. Hoped I'd catch you. Here." He tossed a folded note in William's general direction and vanished. William snorted again and picked it up off the ground. Evans and Merbling had both left, they having actual troops to inspect and command. He envied them bitterly. It was from General Sir Henry Clinton, and hit him in the stomach like a blow.
"In view of your peculiar status, I think it best that you remain with the clerical staff today."
"Sturkus," he said, finding German insufficient to his feelings. "Excrementum of senum filius mulieris prostabilis." His chest was tight, blood was pounding in his ears, and he wanted to hit something. It would be useless to appeal to Sir Henry, he knew that much. But to spend the day essentially kicking his heels in the clerk's tent, for what was there for him to do if he wasn't allowed to carry dispatches or even do the lowly but necessary work of shepherding the camp followers and loyalists? What? Was he to fetch the clerk's dinner in, or hold a torch in each hand when it got dark like a fucking candelabra? He was about to crumple the note into a wad when yet another unwelcome head intruded itself, followed by an elegant body. Captain André, dressed for battle, sword at his side and pistols in his belt. William eyed him with dislike, although, in fact, he was an amiable fellow.
"Oh, there you are, Ellesmere," André said, pleased. "Hoped you hadn't gone off yet. I need you to run me a dispatch, quickly, to Colonel Tarleton with the British Legion, the new provincials, green chaps. You know him."
"I do, yes."
William accepted the sealed dispatch, feeling odd.
"Certainly, Captain." "Good man,"
André smiled, and squeezed his shoulder, then strode out, ebullient with the promise of imminent action. William drew a deep breath, carefully folded Sir Henry's note back into its original shape, and placed it on his cot. Who was to say that he hadn't met André first, and, owing to the urgency of his request, left immediately without reading Sir Henry's note?
He doubted he'd be missed in any case.
Chapter 69 Sparrow Fart. It was perhaps 4 o'clock, Ak Emma. Or before Sparrow Fart, as the British armed forces of my own time used to put it. That sense of temporal dislocation was back again, memories of another war coming like a sudden fog between me and my work, then disappearing in an instant, leaving the present sharp and vivid as Kodachrome. The army was moving. No fog obscured Jamie. He was big and solid, his outlines clearly visible against the shredding night. I was awake and alert, dressed and ready, but the chill of sleep still lay upon me, making my fingers clumsy. I could feel his warmth, and drew closer to him, as I might to a campfire. He was leading Clarence, who was even warmer, though much less alert, ears sagging in sleepy annoyance. "You'll have Clarence," Jamie told me, putting the mule's reins in my hand, "and these, to make sure you keep him, if you should find yourself on your own." These were a heavy pair of horse pistols, holstered and strung on a thick leather belt that also held a shot bag and powder horn. "Thank you," I said, swallowing as I wrapped the reins around a sapling in order to belt the pistols on. The guns were amazingly heavy, but I wouldn't deny that the weight of them on my hips was amazingly comforting, too. "All right," I said, glancing toward the tent where John was. "What about—"
"I've seen to that," he said, cutting me off. "Gather the rest of your things, Sassenach. I've nae more than a quarter hour at most, and I need you with me when we go."
I watched him stride off into the melee, tall and resolute, and wondered, as I had so often before, will it be today? Will this be the last sight I remember of him? I stood very still, watching as hard as I could. When I'd lost him the first time, before Culloden, I'd remembered. Every moment of our last night together. Tiny things would come back to me through the years. The taste of salt on his temple, and the curve of his skull as I cupped his head. The soft, fine hair at the base of his neck, thick and damp in my fingers. The sudden, magical well of his blood in dawning light when I cut his hand and marked him forever as my own. Those things had kept him by me. And when I'd lost him this time to the sea, I'd remembered the sense of him beside me, warm and solid in my bed, and the rhythm of his breathing, the light across the bones of his face in moonlight, and the flush of his skin in the rising sun. I could hear him breathe when I lay in bed alone in my room at Chestnut Street. Slow, regular, never stopping, even though I knew it had stopped. The sound would comfort me, then drive me mad with the knowledge of loss, so I pulled the pillow hard over my head in a futile attempt to shut it out, only to emerge into the night of the room, thick with wood smoke and candle wax, and vanished light, and be comforted to hear it once more. If this time... But he had turned, quite suddenly, as though I'd called his name. He came swiftly up to me, grasped me by the arms, and said in a low, strong voice,
"It willna be today, either."
Then he put his arms around me and drew me up on tiptoe into a deep, soft kiss. I heard brief cheers from a few of the men nearby, but it didn't matter. Even if it should be today, I would remember. Jamie strode toward his waiting companies, loosely assembled, near the river. The breath of the water and the mist rising from it comforted him, keeping him wrapped for a little while longer in the peace of the night, and the deep sense